Happy New Year. Welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on all streaming services and on podcast. My name is Alan Wares, and we are brought to you in association with the wonderful Flowers Unlimited of Hove, more of whom soon. Well, that's it for another calendar year. The third in a row where Brighton and Hove Albion have averaged a top 10 position come the year end. We've now gone 7 matches without a win, 5 of which have been drawn. Though in a sport where context is everything, the draw against Brentford and the draw against Aston Villa felt like 2 totally separate, disparate results. Though, of course, each one merely resulted in a point from each game. To discuss this and more, we welcome back the Albion's former poet of residence, Attila the Stockbroker, a.k.a. John Bain. John, how are you?
I'm all right. Good. Recovering from my operation, which I think
is this something
about.
We want to know about on the radio?
No, it's not something you want to know about, but you know about it anyway. So, but yes. Being a bit careful, but absolutely fine, and looking forward to 2025. I've just written a poem about 2025 and the fact that some people are a bit frightened of it. I tend to just fling open the door and say, bring it on, sort of thing, you know?
It's a number.
Absolutely. It's a number with a lunatic in the White House, but I mean, that's a... There we go.
There's always a lunatic somewhere, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, it's been an interesting time recently on the Albion front. I mean, obviously, we haven't won for 7 games. And for that, there's some people that are getting really, really fed up and angry and really, really angry and frustrated because we're only 10th in the Premier League. I mean, I'm sorry. It just makes me laugh. I just don't understand fickledom. I don't understand fickledom. I just have an incredibly long view, which goes back, frankly, to Hereford. And I'm really pleased with where we are and what we're doing. And I see most of the games. I thought we played well against Brentford. I thought, you know, we were quite unlucky not to win. I didn't go last night. I'm going to beat the next 2 away. I think generally we've played pretty well. And, I just don't feel the same as a lot of people do. And I think that's probably because I've had this long history. And I do still put everything in the context of what went before. Yeah. I can't get angry about us being 10th in the Premier League. I can't. I really can't.
So this rage, A, do you think it's genuine? And B, do you think it's a cultural malaise or has it always been there?
I think the nature, I mean, you know, I get more and more frustrated. I say it every time I talk to you, really. I am more and more frustrated about modern football. The thing that keeps me there is I love the Albion. I've said a million times, I'm like the goldfish owner who still loves his goldfish, but is sick to death of the water it's swimming in. I find the whole sort of entitled, kind of whiny, instant gratification, you know, everything's really, really fantastic. And then 3 matches later, everything's terrible and ghastly. I just find it all.
Oh, beat Villa last night and we're on our way to the Champions League.
It's just not part of my psyche. I don't see things like that. I'm upset mildly for a few minutes when we lose and I'm happy when we win. But then it just flattens out into the rest of my life. And I'm very fortunate to have a very full life. I passionately support the Albion. I go to every single game I can. I organise my gigs around the fixed list, as you know, as much as possible. I love to be there. I love to see them. I love it when they win, when they lose. I'm a bit pissed off for a few minutes, then I forget about it and get on with everything else that I'm doing. And in terms of not winning for 7 games,
let me put this into context in that case. You say no wins in 7, which somewhere down the line is a headline for everyone to rally behind. Oh my God, what's going wrong? But a couple of things I'll say to that. One, there was a time about 3 years ago, Graham Potter lost 6 games in a row.
Yeah,
and there was no thought within the club. I mean, people were cheesed off, but there was no thought within the club that, you know, that anything was going to happen or any there was going to be a change of direction, because we could see the change of direction was always the right way. Then we drew against Norwich, who were relegation bound, and it didn't seem a great result. And then we turned Arsenal over. And then from there, we put 4 past Man United. Then we beat them again early season, put 5 past Leicester. And suddenly the sun was shining again. And yet you know full well that, and you use that phrase, that entitlement, that some people would be barking that the manager must go because we haven't won since, you know, since the dinosaurs were on planet.
Well, it's just fickledom. And as I say, I don't understand it. I don't think for a moment there's any intentional desire to get rid of Hertzler. I think it was a very brave moved to employ him, and I think he's doing a fine job.
So with that in mind, obviously the his previous gig was at I suppose a lot of people will call it your second club.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean,
I mean, obviously you've spoken to people there. What was the feeling at the time, and have you sort of really caught up with anyone and so who's who you know from back in Hamburg to say you know who themselves are catching up with how he's
well,
getting on?
you probably, I mean, I think you know that just a few weeks ago, I was actually over there with my band. We were invited to open the new clubhouse in St. Pauli,
Brilliant.
and we actually did a version of Seagull Scar that Tom Hark. And that was just about a month or so ago. So yes, I've talked to people. I've known that, I've been going there when I can since 1990, and now, of course, because of the connection, there was many people who were very interested to hear about, obviously, how we were seeing Herzlu, and obviously people that have started to follow the Albion a bit in the same way that a few Albion fans have followed St. Pauli a bit. I mean, Brighton's my club, but I go there when I've been going to St. Pauli since 1990 when I got the chance, mainly with gigs in mind, and often managing to see a game as well. And it's not, that they're I think probably thinking that he's doing pretty well. And
Were
as
they
I
cheesed off when he left?
Yeah, they were, although less so because he was coming to us. Because most people have to see Brighton as a progressive club in this sort of, and we don't shout about it as much as St. Pauli do, but they see us as a club sort of set in the same kind of mould. It's generally being quietly progressive in our values and having a good perspective and good community policy and all the rest of it, which we do.
Which
But yeah, they
actually
were.
in the show last well, the Christmas show that we had with Fabian, he himself acknowledged, when we asked him about what he thought, the not just of the club here, but the city, he immediately made the links between that area of Hamburg and the city of Brighton and Hove,
Oh,
especially
absolutely.
the LGBTQ stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, as I told you at the time, my great friend who's the stadium security manager now, Sven Brooks, who was the began the was one of the founders of the original alternative St. Pauli scene, when he ran the fan shop from in a squatted hairdressers from the early 90s, late 80s, early
A
90s.
squatted hairdresser.
That's where they started the alternative fan scene. And he's now head of security at the Midland. He told me that that absolutely is Hützler's sort of base, and that he completely got, what was happening at St. Pauli the moment he went there, and he obviously he's got the same thing with us. And of course he came over in the winter pause last year, last December, January. He came over and saw the Spurs game, obviously, and obviously was obviously presumably felt rather impressed by that. And we had a, you know we had a good we've had a good relationship with them, and so it will continue. And I mean, I think everyone's really happy that he's come here, and certainly we got a great reaction when we played there. And I mean, I don't see a problem with Hertzler at all. I mean, he's unusually young as a manager, but he's an absolute, as you said, he's an absolute football nerd. He lives, eats, breathes, and sleeps the game, so he's not going to be missing out on anything in terms of age. And I think the players respect him, and I think he's doing a great job. I mean, I think we've just been unlucky, really. I mean, it's just, but we've lost two games out of nine, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that was the context I was going to put this in. It's no wins in seven or two defeats in nine.
Which is and two defeats in nine is good in the Premier League.
It's way above our historical average. If you're going to take from 1901 to the present day, as I said, it's our third year in a row where we've averaged top 10, which incidentally was the club's, part of the club's plan, part of their aim, and of which then Roberto Di Zerbi then sort of chastised Paul Barber and Tony Bloom, saying, "Well, why are you only aiming for top 10 when you could and should be aiming for top four?" Which is, I think sort of made their eyebrows do a bungee jump. But you also then think, well, why not? It's a very well-run club, well-run
I
club.
still think we've got a very good chance of getting into Europe. I think the team, I think the squad we've got now is really good, and we're we're
needs
playing.
to be firing on all cylinders, but then that's the whole thing, isn't it? It's that whole thing of form is temporary, class is permanent.
We've owned a few more injuries than we should do. I mean, the
What
one
do
thing
they
I
do on the
struggle.
training ground? Because last year
The one
we
thing,
had this
yeah, I know.
problem.
The one thing I do question, I do think that there may be something wrong. The one area where we may have got it wrong still is the training and the medical staff. I mean, I don't know, but we do
No.
seem to get an inordinately large number of injuries, which don't actually happen during competitive matches. Anyway,
No.
let's move on from. I think we. I mean, I don't see there's any point in going round and round. I mean,
No.
I can say a million times that I don't understand the toys being thrown out of the pram. I don't understand the frustration. I have a much wider perspective. But then I'm 67. I was part of the whole thing, as you were in the
Yeah,
90s. I have a completely different perspective from a 17-year-old, who's just started watching the club in the last few years in the Premier League, and obviously that's his club, or her club. They're in the Premier League, and they haven't won
absolutely.
for
Everyone
seven
has
games.
their own story to
Everyone has
tell.
their own. I don't. So I'm not dissing or slagging off
No,
anybody
no, no,
for
no.
feeling like that, but it's just not how I feel, and I can't really engage with it. I want to talk now about. I
Now,
want
I'll
to
tell
take.
you what we're going to go on to, because you mentioned 17-year-olds, and actually about 3 or 4 minutes ago, you mentioned those magic two words. This is something that a 17-year-old wouldn't have even been born doing. You mentioned those two words, Tom Hark. Now then, 9th of January 2005, you, John, made a lot of Brighton fans do something, one, they didn't want to do and hadn't done for years before or years afterwards. Listen to the chart show.
I know.
But yes, there was a bunch of Brighton fans got together, professionally put together four songs. But you're at the vanguard of it, mate. Tell us the story for those that haven't heard it.
Yeah, well, okay. Obviously, at this point, it was 2000, late 2004. We were right in the battle for the new stadium. We'd saved the club. We knew the future was secure. Obviously, we were back at Withdean, and we were being thwarted in our attempts to get planning permission for the new stadium at Falmer, which is now called the other thing, but I still call Falmer. Basically, simple, really. I was at Ipswich away. And Ipswich away, one of those clubs that always played Tom Hark when they scored. And Tom
Gone
Hark,
music isn't anathema anyway.
and Tom Hark was originally recorded. I mean, it's not originally written by the Piranhas, but the big hit was by the Piranhas from Brighton. Bob Grover, personal friend of mine, died on Christmas Eve. I want to pay huge respects to him in what I'm saying now, because he was part. I mean, but
Well,
Bob
before
was
you
one
go
of
on
the
with the story,
original.
then, John, tell us about Bob.
But Bob was one of the original parts of the punk scene in Brighton, which started at the Vault, which was basically a deconsecrated burial vault under the church hall in North Road, which the punks were given as a rehearsal space and gig venue. And through much of 77 and onwards for a couple of years, it was where we did our gigs, and it was a brilliant place. It was completely weird and
Just for context, I want to say that
very.
we're basically talking about where the Brighthelm Centre is now, yeah?
And it was right under. It was obviously it was a burial vault. So there was some walls were put up, some flimsy walls were put up to separate the burial vault from the gig space and the crypt. And basically, the walls were kicked in or fell in, and lots of skeletons and bones and all the rest of it started appearing. I remember one day I went out to do it because I was doing the door at a gig, and I walked in, and there was a little lead coffin, little baby's lead coffin in the middle of the room. And with the bones still in it, I'm thinking, bloody hell. So I picked it up, moved the bones to one end, and used it as a cash box to take the money as people were coming in.
And people say you've got no soul and you've just sold out for money.
It was a surreal time, I can tell you. It was an absolutely surreal time. But this is where the Brighton punk scene started. And Bob and the Piranhas were very much a part of it. They were the best known Brighton punk band. And then as they developed, they signed to Sire, a major record label. And of course, as we know, a couple of years later, they had this hit, Tom Hark, a new version of an old Kwela song, South African Kwela song, which Bob wrote with some fairly apocalyptically tongue-in-cheek words to about the prospect of a third world war. And it got quite high up in the charts. And it then became a football song. The grounds that had sort of music, which is not something I would ever believe in myself personally. Goal music after music when you score a goal. But many grounds played it, and Ipswich was one. And there we were, in I suppose it was about September 2004. I thought September, October 2004, and I was at Ipswich away, Ipswich School. They played Don Mark, and I thought, hang on a minute, this is ridiculous. That song was written, written, but the
Well, the
hit was
lyrics were written, certainly.
the lyrics were written by Bob. The song was a hit from the Piranhas. They're from Brighton. We have other clubs playing our song back at us when they score against us. This is completely stupid and wrong. So then I thought, right, I'm going to rewrite this. And the reason that I thought that this could work was because at the time we were sponsored by Skint, the record label Skint, Fatboy Slim's record label, with Damien Harris, aka Midfield General, basically in charge, whom I knew vaguely from a long time before when he was part of the Canterbury punk scene, and I was at Kent University organising Rock Against Racism. Anyway, long story. So basically, I approached Skint Records and said, "Look, I've got this idea. I want to do a rewrite Tom Hart with lyrics." Campaigning for our new stadium, will you back it? And they said yes, absolutely. So I did. We got the we the band the musical band to get together was never going to be a problem because I have my band Barnstormer to provide the sort of backbone. Too Many Crooks, wonderful local ska band, provided the ska element and the horns. Ralph Brown came in and played the saxophone, although some people thought it was a kazoo because his mouthpiece was broken. We had a choir
Oh, is
comprising
that
you
what
and
the
Paul.
reason is?
I found that out from Too Many Crooks just recently. We had the choir, Fowl for All Choir, which was all the people that had been campaigning so well for the stadium. So you know, Paul Sammer, obviously in the Vanguard, and Tim Carter, and
There
the
was the
late great
Swallows, there
Errol
was the
Watts, and
Bashfords.
absolutely. And
I managed to stick my head in the
Paul
door.
Sammer, Paul out of tune Sammer, and so we made this record, a new version of Tom Hart. Our Brighton fans are angry. We've been messed around since the Wayward Archer sold the Goldstone
You
Ground.
really didn't want to sing Wayward, did you?
No, I didn't, but I knew I had to. If you listen to the version just recorded recently in São Paulo, you'll hear very different lyrics.
Okay.
So basically, we recorded that, and we called it a song of mine, Roll Up for the Donkey Derby, about when Palace got to Wembley for the first time, played Liverpool and lost 4-3, plus two versions of Sussex by the Sea, ska versions, which did sound like a kazoo because of Ralph Brown's broken mouthpiece. And then Skint sort of did the production. So we had lots of physical copies because it was still the days of physical single sales. It was just moving from physical to online at that time. Plus, we had online sales. The whole idea was planned for the record to come out immediately after Christmas, because nobody, everybody, all the other records, all the other big companies, all the rest of it were competing for the Christmas market. So basically, straight after Christmas, hardly anything was released. And I knew from my mate John Otway's success in having hits manufactured in this way that if enough people from Brighton, plus our mates from all around the country and indeed further afield, places like St. Pauli, bought the single all at the same time in the first week of January, we could get in the charts. And that is exactly what happened. The online thing was going by then, and the sort of just about up and running North Stand Chat and all the other online chat show thing, the chat room things, really got stuck into it. There was physical copies available, so we basically got everybody to buy physical copies at the same time or
Can
the
I
same
just say
couple
that
of days in Brighton.
the sleeve design was world
Yeah,
class?
and you designed the sleeve, and we got Charlie Oatway and various other players came to sign. So people bought it from HMV, and then Charlie Oatway and company signed the records that they wanted them signed. That was all great fun. And
You did a live gig outside Rounder Records.
we did a live gig, which was fun as well. And then the day came for the chart rundown, and it was really funny because I was listening to it, just cuddled up with my wife, and I was thinking maybe top 30 if we're really lucky. I reckon top 40. So the top 40 went up. So the last first 10, 40 to 31, no Tom Hart. And then the second 10, no Tom Hart. It's like, what the hell's going
And
on
the
here?
amount of rubbish you're having to
I
listen
know. Oh,
to.
it was like, oh God, it was absolute awful smegma. It was terrible. But there we were at number 17. And out of that, we got features in all the national press, the whole campaign. The most important thing was to raise money, was to raise awareness of the campaign and raise some money for the 40 Note Fund, the Alive and Kicking Fund. We raised
That's
over 2 grand. I don't know exactly how much it was, but it was a fair bit. And of course, we got features in all the national press. I was on Radio 4, on the television. We did loads and loads of stuff. It really, really helped the campaign. It was a huge,
Do you remember the gig that you
huge
did the
amount of fun.
night of the chart rundown? We all piled
Yeah.
down
Yeah, we
to
did. We it was down. It was
BM1.
in Hove, in the basement of some place
It
in
was a
Hove.
place in at the bottom of Preston
It
Street.
was. It was. And Mark McGee turned up as well, which was brilliant.
Didn't you have an argument with you were trading insults in German?
Because he was from Hyslop, of course, and I was wearing my St. Pauli top, and he used to manage HSV and play for HSV, the other Hamburg club. And the Volksparkschweine, the Volkspark pigs, as we call, as St. Pauli call them.
You're
So
trading
yeah, it was
insults in
just
German.
brilliant.
I would love to have heard
It
that.
was absolutely fun. It was really great fun. It was just one of the really funny stories of the, it was a long campaign. It was exhausting. But ultimately, one of the things that, it was also often, apart from exhausting and sometimes frustrating and sometimes a bit boring when you had to sort of do the same thing over and over again. But sometimes it was just absolute fun, and that was an absolute pleasure. That whole story was an absolute pleasure from beginning to end. The funny thing is, we could have got higher than number 17, but they ran out of copies. They didn't print enough copies. They didn't think it would sell
Right.
that many because we sold loads abroad. St. Pauli bought a load. All kinds of people abroad bought copies of it. Obviously, many people who in Brighton bought copies of something that they would never listen to. There were varying opinions on the quality of the record. I thought it wasn't bad. I didn't
It was
think it was
fine.
brilliant. I thought it was average. I mean, it was the idea that mattered, and I think we covered the idea really well. And I think it was average. I was very proud of Roll Up for the Donkey Derby. That was my song, and that actually, I think, of the people that enjoyed it, I think that's the one they enjoyed the most. Sussex by the Sea then got turned into the music that I played at the end if we won at foul at with theme, which was quite funny as well. That divided people. I mean, it did sound like it was on a kazoo, but I quite like that. In fact, so but then I'm a lo-fi anti-commercial music fan. I'm not into I'm not into pop music. I'm not into sort of easy listening kind of chart hits and boy bands. I like stuff that's weird and sounds old
Yeah,
and
you say you don't not into chart hits, but there is a Top of the Pops postscript, isn't there?
There was a Top of the Pops postscript, which was that we were given notification that the ugliest, oldest bunch of punks and skinheads were going to be on Top of the Pops, and then we were given notification that Busted had split up. So Top of the Pops that week was going to be a special devoted entirely to the history of Busted. Now, we all know, don't we, that bands like Busted don't split up. They
They're
are
told
formed
to.
by a corporation, and they split up when the corporation decides it is time for them to go off to do their various solo projects. And so obviously that's what happened. So obviously they were launching the solo project. So that was the end of that. But, I mean, it was just really good fun. And I mean, for those people who weren't born then or whatever, it was something that you could only really have done at that age, because the charts now, the singles thing is so, I mean, it's all complete. I mean, what is it? It's streaming.
Well, there's
No
sales
impact
and
whatsoever.
streaming, but
There's
yeah,
no, there's no.
it's.
I mean, we were, you know, when we, when I was growing up, I mean, I'm 67. In the early 70s, all through the 70s, the Top of the Pops and the television, there was, it was incredibly, incredibly, incredibly powerful beyond anything you could possibly imagine. Then that gradually decreased, but by the 1990s, the 2000s, it wasn't really, it wasn't much of a story. It was enough of a story for it still be it to be a story in 2005. But now, I mean, who cares about what's in the charts or what's number one, really? I mean, I don't think even people of 13 are that bothered really anymore, because it's all just on Spotify and on the streaming services,
Well,
and
it's also
it
that it's
doesn't.
also that it's who the record companies, who the corporations, as you say, tell you to. I mean, I think even at that particular time, though, and we are talking 20 years ago, is that we were also slightly kiboshed by the fact that it was the 70th anniversary of the birth of Elvis. And I think there was a time, certainly in the early part of that run, where Seagull Scar, because the initial rush, we were actually at number one for a short time,
You
and
were,
then they released, I don't know, about 20 Elvis songs. They then sort of took their place in the queue and pushed us. And I think that we were at number 17. If it hadn't been for Elvis, there's a high possibility. I mean, you say it's Busted that didn't get us onto the Top of the Pops. It was Elvis that stopped us getting into the top 10, which shakes fist angrily. But no, it was good fun. I mean, I remember being in the what do you call it, the Falmouth Royal Choir. And putting the lyrics up on the glass pane between the studio and the recording room, including I think someone just typed up E or for Roll Up for the Donkey Derby. No, it was good fun. I'm sort of obviously it was mostly your gig, but I was pleased, really, really pleased to play, the part that I did. And it obviously it's not about me, it's about everyone, and including not just those who put it together, but
It
those who
was the whole
bought
point.
it.
It was
No,
just
it's
one more example of us all getting together to do something using all the different skills that we had. Obviously, it was very fortuitous. It couldn't have happened if at the time we hadn't had Skint Records as our sponsor, because it meant that all the money that was made could go straight back to the club, and it meant that they were really motivated to help and do it. And it was just one of those. It was serendipity, and it really worked. I would like just to pay a tribute to Bob Grover, who
Go on
died
then.
or died on Christmas Eve. He was, as I say, one of the founders of the Brighton punk scene. A lovely guy. He had the Piranhas, then he formed other bands and was doing so did solo stuff in the pubs, and then he reformed the Piranhas. I put them on many times, including at my Glastonbury Festival. And he was just one of the he was one of the he just a typical Brighton quirky bloke. I mean, working class guy from Brighton with a really great sense of humour and a really sort of alternative, different way of looking at life. And we total respect to me. You rest in peace, Bob. You were a sound, blooming sound bloke. Cheers.
Didn't you actually offer him the gig of singing the song in the first
Oh
place?
yeah. I mean, I said, look, mate. This is when I come up with the idea. I said, first of all, mate, this is your song. Obviously, not originally your song, but you wrote these words. I'm rewriting it. Do you want to sing on it? He said, no, John. You go ahead. You've got my blessing. Absolutely. You go ahead and do it. And that was it. He wasn't someone. Me. I'm really out front and out there. And he was not like that at all. He was quite introverted, and he, for someone who was in a band, fronting a band or co-fronting a band with the other singer, Johnny Helmer, he was a very understated sort of chap, was Bob, very, very, very humble. So yeah, it was a lovely time, and I've huge respect for him, and very proud of what we did, because it was just a little part in the battle to save the club and get the new stadium.
Absolutely. May your sweet soul rest in peace, Bob. You're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on all streaming services and on podcast. My name's Alan Wares. AD is, I think, a little bit busy on New Year's Eve. I think that his work have strangleholded him back into the office. So sadly can't do this week's show, but he'll be back next week, rest assured. This show is brought to you in association with the wonderful Flowers Unlimited of 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove. Our very great thanks to Dave Costa, who is the sponsor of the show these days. So anything floral, then Flowers Unlimited, the official flower supplier of Brighton and Hove Albion, is your place to go.
Is Dave Costa? Is that Dave Costa, who's Liz Costa's son, by any chance?
Stepson.
Stepson, right? I
Yes.
thought it might be. Yes, I thought it might be. Yeah,
If you go
yeah.
back to the show that we did with Dave, the first show of the season, Dave explains the family tree to us. So,
Right.
thank you very much indeed, Dave. So, for anything floral, head to Flowers Unlimited of Portland Road in Hove. Now then, like I say, we come to the end of 2024, the 124th calendar year of Albion's existence. If you really want to get snotty about this, it's the 18th year calendar year of the Albion Roar's existence. So, what are the headlines? What are the stories to be had? I suppose probably the biggest one is that Roberto Di Zerbi decided enough was enough. He wasn't getting what he wanted. The club wasn't prepared to meet halfway. He wasn't prepared to meet halfway. They never did get it together, and shook hands and said thanks for all the fish and left. That left us with a quandary, another manager to find. It is getting annoying when we have really good managers who just up sticks and leave for a variety of reasons. But we recruited Fabian Hertzler. I think we've talked about him several times, I think the direction of travel is still positive, irrespective of the last most recent few games. I'm going to blame poor finishing and poor decision making on the pitch, which the players do know how to deal with. That's my broad overview. There are bits and pieces which everyone could improve on. But by the same token, I don't think anyone is actually considering us the final package, the ultimate team yet. We have a long way to go, and it's that long way to go which is so exciting about what the club can do.
That's right.
The
That's
biggest
true.
headline I'm taking from 2024 is the comparison to 2023. which was in all competitions. We scored 63 goals. But if you're going to, which you think, oh, it's not too bad. But in 2023, we scored 105. I didn't do the stats as to how many we conceded because I think it would depress me too much. So, yeah, the goals have dried up, and especially over the past few weeks. I have also done a list as to who scored what. I think it's probably fairly obvious that it's going to be Pedro and Welbeck, who are the leading scorers in all competitions I'm talking about here. João Pedro ended up with 11 goals in 2024, six in the league, five in the various cups. Danny Welbeck, who is chasing down Pascal Gross's Premier League record, he scored nine goals in 2024 in the league and one in the cup. Next on that list is Simona Dingra, who scored seven, and he finished off his account yesterday with a good finish against Aston Villa. Of course, when I say the highest number of goals in the Premier League, it doesn't really count because for me, it's still Michael Robinson, who's on 37, still eight ahead of Danny Welbeck. John, 2023 was an amazing year. 2024, I think we kind of just regrouped a little bit, lick our wounds.
I don't see licking wounds or anything like that. I just think we've been a bit unlucky in front of goal. I think we've done some brilliant recruiting in the summer, using the money that the ridiculous, Chelsea, idiots and others have thrown at us. Recruited some fine players, and it just hasn't quite gelled. But I mean, you won't find anybody more laid back than me about all this. I mean, I am just supremely happy still to be where we are, to be watching their team play such brilliant football. The fact is, we have beaten all the major clubs now, all the top six, whatever you want to call them. Now we've beaten Man City as well in a proper game, not the end of season one like last time. And we are a match for anybody. And the fact that the other interesting thing, I suppose, we could touch on is it's palpably obvious now that we actually play better against the teams whose self-appointed role in life, not just self-appointed by them, but by pundits, by modern football generally, is their self-appointed position is that they are bigger than Brighton and they should beat us. And we do better against them than we do against the teams at the bottom. And the reason for that is that the teams at the top, they feel that they've got to attack, that they can't play defensively against us. They can't just put up God knows how many in front of the ball. They have to attack us. There's an expectation even now that we are little Brighton and they should beat us. And so we play better against them. That's the way it goes. I mean, I don't really see, I don't think there's any obvious sort of way of solving the problem of not scoring goals because we have the players that can do it. I mean, investing in a new striker, for God's sake, how many strikers have we got? And they're all people that can score goals. I mean, I can't think of anybody out there, apart from very, very few incredibly well-known players who would do better than what we got now. The big mystery for me is what's happened with Ferguson. I know we've been through this over and over again. And he came back and showed a little tiny bit of what he had when he first started, and then it seems to have gone off again, although he really hasn't been given a chance again. I mean, it's come to the point now where it seems that the management have kind of not lost faith in him exactly, but he's not the one who's brought on really when we're really desperate for a goal. He comes on almost as an afterthought, which is a shame, but I can see why, because at the moment there is something seriously up. I mean, I don't know if you've heard anything that I
Not a
haven't.
clue, mate. All I'd say is you don't become rubbish overnight,
No, of course not.
and
And
that the talent is still there.
I have a tremendous suspicion. I keep hearing ridiculous rumours, like the idea, last one I heard was that there was going to be a direct swap for him and Rashford, right? Now, I think that's obviously complete rubbish, but I do have a
But that's
haunting.
Marcus Rashford, who's just signed a 5-year contract. Yeah,
Yeah,
brilliant.
I know it's ridiculous, but I mean, I do have a feeling that if he did go, that he'd probably suddenly turn into a great player again.
Well, I mean, if that
And
if it means that he has to spend time elsewhere playing first team football in order to find his form, in order to find his confidence, because like I say, the talent is clearly there. But as we all know, and I'm loath to say sort of what's in his head or what he's whether it's a confidence thing. We're not there day in, day out. We don't know. We can only speculate based on what we see on the pitch. So whilst we know that the talent is there, we just the end product in there, with the exception of that second goal against Wolves, where, he was, it
That
was, I was like, classic Ferguson. I don't know how you can have a classic Ferguson at 19, but the player that we've had, and has shown such promise. But like you say, he's 19. I mean, with the exception of the best players in the world, who was the finished product at 19?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure it will come, just because we know that the meat and potatoes are there. As to why it's happening, well, that's what Fabian Hertzl has paid for.
Yeah, I mean, I've no idea. I'm really no idea. I don't think there's any point in him going to sort of a lower league club or whatever suggested. If he was going to go anywhere, I would think he would need to go to a top club and just be thrown in the deep end and see what happened. But anyway,
Maybe a
no.
top club in Europe if he has to go, but even then, there will come a time where he'll take his chance. We don't know. But
No.
yeah, the point is, we do talk a lot of recency bias, and therefore we think, well, how's it all going? I mean, I'm just thinking back to the end of last season, so the middle of the year, and after the Roma defeat, you couldn't help feeling that the energy, the zing had slightly gone. Now, we were kind of, there's a lot of times where we were having, a lot of the under 21s, some of the 17-year-olds on the bench because, one, the squad hadn't been fully realized, and
And they
two,
had
we were
loads of
having a
injuries.
lot of injuries, still having a
Had
lot of
loads
injuries.
around the time of the Roma defeat. Of course, we had loads of injuries, and that continued. I mean, and one of the reasons why things weren't so good, haven't been so good in the last 12 months, is because of injuries. Now, the one area where I do join the moaners to a degree, or I have joined the moaners to a degree, is on the question of injuries which don't happen on the actual field of play during games. I mean, if people are getting injured in training to the degree that seems to have happened with us, then that seems to me to mean that there's something wrong with the training, or there's something wrong with the medical staff, or whatever. But then, what do I know? Maybe it's just bad luck. But I mean, I don't know. I mean,
It's. I mean. It, I mean.
I.
I think that the nature of certainly what Graham Potter asked of his players, and certainly what Roberto Di Zerbi asked of his players, and I think to an extent what, excuse me, Fabian Hertzl is asking of his players, I think it, that again, it's speculation. Is that there's a lot of physical stress being placed upon them. I mean, that Brighton team, for the most part, is a very, very fit, well-drilled team.
Yeah.
They do know how to go hunting down the ball, and they do it with such intensity. And even, for instance, with last night's game against Villa, they were doing it up to minute, I was about to say 95, but seeing as there was 12 minutes added time in the first half, I mean, whatever minute it was. But the point is that they kept going and kept going, and that asks a lot of their players, and that's where sometimes an injury will kick in. So yeah, there was the bit at the beginning of the year, certainly after the Roma defeat, is that we were, I wouldn't say we're not sort of Harry Redknapp's down to the bare bones, but we weren't putting out anything like as strong a sides as we could have done. Whereas if you then fast forward to the summer and the acquisitions that the club had, one, because they knew that they'd had 2 years' worth of nine-figure profits. The second one of which has yet to be announced, but it, seeing as it includes the sale of Moises Caicedo, then full well there's going to be a healthy profit announced next time. So and also another thing, because other clubs are were in certain financial straits because of the way that their business model is run,
Yeah,
is that the Albion were able to pick up certain players, and I'm looking at Minté, for instance, cheaper and better than they could have done on account of the fact the other clubs had one and.
that was the really good bit there was, sorry to butt in, but that was the really good bit of planning by Bloom and everybody to basically identify quite clearly, we have this money coming in. A lot of other clubs are going to be hamstrung by financial fair play, by all the regulations, which will give us the opportunity. And of course they did. And we've signed some great players. I don't think any of them are no good. In a sense, in some ways, it's just we've got so many. There's so many players now that they're competing with each other. And that is, again, that's good as long as they're happy, and as long as they're happy to do so. I mean, I'm very relaxed about it. I think we'll have a really good stab at getting back into Europe next year. I can see some great results happening, plus a few disappointing ones. I think we'll continue to do better against the better clubs. That just seems to be the way things are with us. Who knows? I mean, we've had this run of without winning, but we've drawn most of them, and the difference between a draw and a win isn't very much, obviously. In terms of, well, I mean, I, if, for instance, I mean, you know, the toys out of the pram stuff. I mean, there's some. We played well in the first half against Brentford, and Enciso had that wonderful shot that hit the post. If that had gone in and it carried on for the rest of the game, then it would have all been sweetness and light. I mean, it's fine margins, and some people, frankly, who don't. Who get too worked up about the situation, and just don't take a longer view. But that's just me. I mean,
Absolutely. Well,
I think I've probably said all that I've got to say about it now.
no, that's quite. I was going to say everything is in context, and if you're going to look at context, as I said at the top of the show, the Brentford game and the Aston Villa game, a draw in both games. Now, admittedly, Brentford was at home, Aston Villa was away, which under certain circumstances doesn't often mean that much. However, Brentford, as you just said, Brentford was a game where we absolutely bossed the first half, played really well, did everything except score, which obviously is a problem because it's the single most important part of football. Enciso had a Premier League record of 8 chances in the first half. But it wasn't just down to him. It was for me, there was poor finishing, poor decision making. And then you fast forward to the Villa game. Again, we draw. And yet it's seen as a point gained rather than two lost. Yes, we could have won, but then so could Villa. It was probably a decent game for the neutral to watch. So everything has to be in context. But one thing I do want to actually raise with you, I mean, we can sort of point fingers and say, well, he could have done better there, he could have done better there. I don't like to see Brighton and Hove Albion players throwing their elbow around.
Well, I
I don't
didn't.
know if you recall this, is that, and there's been much discussion, that there was a yellow card offered to a Brentford player for pulling Pedro's shirt back. And I don't know if you've seen the footage, but within that, just as it was finishing off, Pedro really threw his elbow back. Now, he missed. The referee didn't really spot it. VAR looked at it, decided that. No red card, no sanction because he missed and the other player didn't need to get out of the way of it, which is in flat contradiction to the Premier League rules, saying that if a player does, in this instance, throw their elbow back, whether or not they connect, it's a red card offence. So are you familiar with what it is I'm talking about here, John? Have you seen this?
No, I haven't. At the time, it didn't register, and to be honest, it hasn't really registered since. I mean,
Well, if you saw it now, let's put it this
it's
way,
the
if you
sort of
saw
thing I
it
used to do
now.
when I was playing rugby quite a lot. So,
Yeah, well, then, yeah.
yeah, I mean, no, he shouldn't have done it. But I mean,
No, it's one of those that if he'd have connected, then there's a good chance the Brentford player would have been off to intensive care. It was,
I
and
don't. I mean, no, I didn't see that. But yeah, it's wrong, obviously. I mean, whether you can, I don't think you can actually punish somebody for something that doesn't happen for the intent of it.
it was the
But
intent, that's
but
the
then he
point.
wouldn't have had the intent to have actually hurt him. So, it's a moot point, isn't it? I mean, I
Yeah,
don't know.
well, I mean, the letter, well, it's not even the letter of the law. I mean, the law is quite specific. And you said
So
whether he connected or not.
why do you think, if the law is specific, why do you think they haven't taken any
Well,
action?
that's the point, isn't it? It was kind of interesting that the Sky Sports do their show with Dermot Gallagher. Now, you can agree or disagree, and I think there's a lot of people who just sometimes don't get the laws of the game and say, well, hang on, why didn't that happen? Well, because that's the law. And in fact, it raises another point from a game early last year that I didn't realise that. Well, there's a goal that Sheffield United scored up at Bramall Lane, and it was given offside because although the ball came off Buonanotte, it was accidental or he didn't know anything about it. Now, I didn't know that that therefore negates any offside consideration. So he was still given offside, even though it came off him. But because it came off him accidentally or didn't know anything about it, it doesn't count.
All right.
So there's still laws that we're all still picking up on. But like I say, they on Sky Sports, they read it out Dermot Gallagher, he said, well, he's just had a late Christmas present or early Christmas, whatever it was. Yeah, late Christmas present, because there is absolutely no reason why he should not got a red card for that. And I say it was the elbow was kind of parallel to his shoulder. He clearly threw it back. He missed by about 6 inches, but that's not the point. He clearly threw the elbow at him.
Right.
And I'll say the law is clear that, if you're going to do that, whether you connect or not, it's a bit like sort of trying to throw a punch at someone. It doesn't matter whether you hit them or not, you've thrown a punch, and is therefore a red card. It's the same thing. Pedro's a lucky boy there, and thankfully, because VAR had looked at it, there can't be any retrospective action. So he's a lucky boy, but my point is ever is well, you don't like to see it in football, and you'd like to think that actually you support a club where the players don't do that, because you just sometimes you don't want to be seen to supporting a club of thugs.
Well, I don't. I mean, I don't think we're a club of thugs. I don't. I don't think not at all. I mean, I think it was a
Not at
one-off
all.
event. I don't see that happening all the time.
No,
The Albion. So
no.
no,
No,
not.
it's fine, but let's fast forward to the Villa game. Have you seen the highlights?
I saw them. I saw them last night.
Sure. So, that was well. It was an improved performance, certainly in front of goal. Villa clearly a decent side at home, but it's one of those again. You put it into context. You think, well, we've got the same result as we get against Brentford, but it was just such a much better performance, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's. I mean, I go to most of the games. I refuse to even contemplate going to a match, which, due to modern football whim, is put on a at 7:45 on a what day of the week was it? A Monday night, when it's virtually impossible to get back with any it's the. I mean, for me. The discussion of the Villa game is more to do with the ridiculous time at the ridic at this point in the year of when it happened. I couldn't, frankly, I couldn't
Still
believe.
not as bad as a couple of years ago, a Boxing Day night at 8 o'clock at
Well,
home.
I'm going to Ipswich on the next one. I mean, I've made choices. I'm going to Ipswich, which is a Thursday night. I'm staying in Ipswich, seeing my mate Martin Newell, talking music, going up north, staying with my friends in Ossett, and then going to Man U. I mean, you can do that so many times a season, and I can do it because I'm a self-employed performance poet and musician now, officially with my pension, but still doing as many gigs as ever. If you've got a proper job, if you've got a day job, and I mean, I've got total respect to everyone who went there. I mean, it's just brilliant, but it's not right. I mean, one of the things that we don't talk about enough, I don't think, on this program or more
Yeah,
generally,
go on.
is the way that the fans are now so far down the pecking order with this whole television thing. I mean, it is, and the way that it's changed, the way that they leave it so late now before they announce the picks and the
God,
fixtures.
they always miss their own deadlines. I mean, they actually
But
set the
why
deadline
they
for
can't
when
just
the.
say at the beginning of the season, this is what we're going to do for each.
Well, they do. That's my point. And they then miss them. They actually
Yeah.
set dead. Okay, so. For January, February, we're going to let people know by, let's say, November the 15th. And they miss that deadline completely arbitrarily.
Well, I know, and for most people, it's an annoyance, and for some people who have particular forms of work, it is a real annoyance. For me, who has spent the last 40 years, where possible, organising my gigs around the fixture lists, to not know until 6 weeks or whatever beforehand whether the game is going to be Friday night, Saturday 12:30, Saturday 3, Saturday 5:30, Sunday 2,
Well,
Sunday 4.
additional to that is those who want to book train tickets
Yeah.
3 months in advance. Because if you're going to buy a cheap train ticket, and it's the story that comes back is, well, you knew it was going to change, you take your chances, and you think, well, that's not reasonable. You
No.
buy a train ticket. Now you buy it for a particular train. I'm going to get the 10, 12, whatever it is that goes from Brighton to wherever. And I'm paying £12 where it would normally be 35 quid, blah blah blah, only for the game to be arbitrarily moved. Now I know that, for instance, the football so footballers, sorry, the Football Supporters Association have been trying to lobby the government on account of the fact that, that they're the main stakeholders in the rail operators, to ask them to refund tickets for those where there's games that have changed. And of course, and each every time the rail operators will put up some sort of interim or office junior and get absolutely nowhere. So they don't, so as much as the TV companies don't care, certainly the rail companies don't care either. It's, you bought your ticket, tough. You knew it was going to be a
I've
lottery.
now got to the point. I mean, there are ways around it for me. I mean, I can, if I plan it carefully, I can sort of more or less, if I've got the gig right in the city centre and the grounds in the city centre, even if it's a 5:30 kickoff on a Saturday, I can get there in time. It's just monumentally trying to organise a weekend of stuff. It's monumentally irritating. I mean, that's a personal gripe for me. But the general sort of fact is that the paying fact that the customers, the supporters, the ones that they see as customers and we see as supporters, the people that basically fill the grounds to create the atmosphere, which then means that they can televise something which is good entertainment on the television. We should be given far, far more respect than we are. And
Absolutely.
in mainland Europe, right across, I mean, in France at the moment, they've got this great big thing about League Two being, having the same thing happen in League Two in France now, because there's far fewer fans and everything, and they're mucking around with the timings there. It's wrong. It is absolutely wrong because, we are ultimately still, we are
Still
the
the main
people that
stakeholders, because I remember
are.
this one thing. One thing is that Sky, let's say Sky, but for Sky we're talking about the broadcasters, is that they want to broadcast something where they have a full house. So it's absolutely imperative that they don't cheese off the fans too much, otherwise those fans won't turn up. And I go back to the Brentford game from 2 years ago, where the official crowd was 30,000 and something, and the real crowd was a couple of men and their dog. And they won't put that on. And in fact, if you go to Spain, there's been La Liga clubs that have been fined for not having full stadiums when their matches are on TVE or Sky Sports Spain or whatever it might be. And it's an absolute farce. So it's not just a British problem. It's just that because the Premier League is seen as this all rich, all pervasive, sort of corporate juggernaut, that the fans are even less of a consideration, which is quite perverse when you consider that the further you go down the pyramid, the loyalty of fans is actually that much more pervasive. And I'm thinking of, when we go and watch Worthing and there's 2,000 there, and that's tier six, and you don't even get remotely close to that in any European country. There's that loyalty does that, that there is a greater loyalty to a hometown fan. And it's one of those things that the broadcasters just, I won't say they go out their way to upset anyone, but you say we're way down the consideration. I don't think we're on the consideration at all, John.
I mean, and the fact of the matter is that it just, if it carried on like this, there will eventually become a kind of
The next one, I worry about bumping down the pipeline. And I think this is one of those that's going to be quite polarizing. And I've got fairly strong feelings about this, but, and let's put it this way, I understand what the alternative argument is, but it's not strong enough for me to change my mind. So if someone can come up with a killer argument, great, is showing matches live on the telly on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock in this country. I'm fundamentally against it. Not necessarily because the likes of Brighton would lose out, but when Brighton aren't at home, Worthing, I go and watch Worthing.
Yeah, absolutely. So do I, as you know.
And I fear that it's the non-league clubs more than anything that would miss out, rather than the Premier League clubs.
I'm not really sure about that because actually, I think the reason that people, so many people, the reason that non-league attendances have gone up and up and up in recent times, I think, is because some people are just so hacked off with modern football
Well, that is an addition to it. Yes, I
they
agree.
abandon their kind of historical club and go and watch, a lower league club nearby. I don't think that will affect it at all, frankly. I mean, I'm, you know, I, I'm, I don't know. I don't think showing, I mean, I think there's too much football on television anyway. I understand why it happens. I understand that, it's brought a lot of money into the game, which meant that the standards are higher. I mean, I totally accept that the players, that the general standard of play and everything is higher than it used to be, and that, and the money coming into the game has been beneficial in some ways, although the amount of money that players get paid now and the whole the transfer fee thing, to me, it's just completely nuts. I mean, if it hadn't been for everything that we've done to save the club and the history of the club, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel when I go to Whitehawk or I go to Worthing, I feel completely in my element.
Yeah.
I feel in my element. I feel in my element in the North Stand, standing as we do, singing as we do. Absolutely, I feel in my element at the Albion. I would never. When I'm in a situation when I'm travelling around doing my concerts and the Albion aren't playing. And I've got the option. I would never ever go to another to a Premier League, even a Championship club, because I want to watch a match every weekend when I can. I go to non-league. I go to a National League or lower, to places normally to places I've not been before, and I absolutely love it. I mean, I absolutely love it. It's a completely different kind of feeling from watching the Albion. Obviously, club
Having a
got no
beer
stadium.
while watching the game, if nothing
I know.
else.
I mean, on last Saturday, well, whenever it was, I don't think it was Saturday, but the last time Whitehall played,
Yeah.
I was there. It was absolutely hilarious. They were playing Dulwich Hamlet, who are, they're both sort of progressive sort of clubs with these, so Whitehall in the first half, Whitehall's goalkeeper was sent off after having made a terrible mistake and then basically rugby tackling the attacker as he was about to score. So we thought that was that. And then the second half, with 10 men and the centre half in goal, they stormed back and won 2-1, playing
Brilliant.
down the ridiculous slope towards the ridiculous corrugated iron construction that everyone calls the Din End, which is basically turned into a test department gig by about 100 Whitehawk ultras. Now, I've never heard so much noise from 100 people anywhere. It was just about 300, 400 people in the ground, about 100 ultras making an absolute racket. It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I don't feel the same way as I do about watching the Albion. I don't have as much invested in it, but as a simple afternoon of pleasure, it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely.
And yes, you could drink a proper beer standing on a proper terrace, swaying up and down
Are they
and
still doing the car keys bit?
oh yeah. So well, that the car keys thing comes from that comes from Germany. That the key moment. That's a German thing that's been going for years.
Oh, so it's luckily that the word for key, as in a key that opens
Schlüssel.
your car, is also the same word for key meaning important.
I'm not sure it is in German actually,
Because
but
that's the whole thing as to what it is. They jangle the car keys because it's a key moment in the match.
yeah, it was a Schlüssel. I speak German. I'm just trying to think what a key moment in. Maybe that's true. I mean,
I mean, it
I'm
works in English, let's put it that
that.
way.
It works in English. Whether it does in German, I'm not sure. Schlüssel is the word for a key, car key or whatever. And the key helped. I would just say something like helped.
And while John considers his English and German there, all I've got to say is that's all we got time for this show and indeed for 2024. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Thank you to everyone who's been on board this year. All our guests are single listener. Happy New Year to you all. So you've been listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on streaming services, and on podcast. And to close us out, John.
This is our hit. For those who haven't heard, who weren't born then, this was our hit in 2005, 9th of January or 9th to 15th of January 2005. We got to number 17 in the charts when the charts really mattered, because they still did more or less then. And it really was, though I say it myself, a moment of real importance in the long battle to raise the awareness and the funds to get the club to where we are today.
dragon.